Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. When you hear Dick Beardsley's story, you might suspect he isn't quite mortal. That is, until you realize he's as painfully human as the rest of us. His is a story of hardship, hope, survival, and redemption. He's a Minnesota native and athlete. Dick Beardsley is coming to South Dakota next week, Monday morning at 10. He speaks at the Joy Center at Black Hill State University. And then again, Tuesday morning at 10 at the King Center Hall of Fame Room at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. And Dick Beardsley joins us on the phone now. Dick, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning, Lori. Thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to coming out this next week.
Well, we can't wait to meet you in person. For folks who don't know as much of your story, you're also a best-selling author and motivational speaker, one of the top American distance runners of all time, exemplified by the 1982 Boston Marathon time of 2:08:53 in the epic duel in the sun with Alberto Salazar, and the only man to have ever run 13 consecutive personal bests in the marathon. That's just a sliver of your life story, though. But I want to start with a little bit of running, because it's been so important to you throughout your entire life. How did you really get started in running, in the sense that you knew, hey, I could do this better, I could take this to the next level?
You know, that's a great question, Lori, because the only reason I even got involved in athletics was I was such a shy kid growing up, and I thought it would help me if I could earn myself a letter jacket. I thought it might help me get a girlfriend. So I went out for football, like most, you know, young boys want to do, and play football. And I remember I got gang tackled the first day of practice, and I got up out of that pile of guys, and my helmet's on crooked, and I'm aching, and I'm thinking, there's not a girl alive that's worth going through this. And so I went up for the cross country team, and I didn't even know what it was. But I went out, and I wasn't very good at all. But I fell in love with the sport, but never in my wildest dreams, you know, when I ran that first day of cross country practice, and we did a 3-mile run, and I had to walk the last mile because I just was, you know, I wasn't in good shape or anything, and yet, you know, just a few years down the road, you know, I 7 years after I graduated from high school, I ran the Boston Marathon and you know, took Alberto Salazar, the world record holder at the time, right down to a sprint finish. But, you know, I've been running now for 47 years, I think, Lori, and I'm slower than molasses in January now, but I still love getting up every morning and going out for a little run.
Yeah, well, you're slow as everybody else's heavy aspiration, I think, in some ways.
Well, I don't know about that, but I sure still do enjoy it.
What do you enjoy about it now, after all that you've been through in life, and after, you know, after being able to, you know, be at the Boston Marathon with the press of crowd and police escorts and news media? Is just insane when you watch the footage of that. But when you're out running today or taking a walk today, what are you thinking about in the context of this life that has been so extraordinary?
You know, it's that hour every morning that I have where it's just me. It's just me out there, and you know, I'm a busy person. You know, I'm also a fishing guide. In fact, I'm out on a trip right now with some folks ice fishing here in northern Minnesota. And people kind of pull on your strings a little bit. Well, you know, wanting you to do this and do that. And I try to accommodate everybody as much as I can, but that morning, and I'm an early riser. I usually get up about 3:45 in the morning, and I get out for my run, and it's just me out there, and it's, you know, one-on-one with the good Lord, and it just gives me time to think, so I like the mental part of it, what it does for me, and then I like the physical part of it too. And I, you know, even though I run slow now, and when you get done, you know, to me, it energizes my day, and it's a great way to get, you know, the day started. And those very few days that I miss and don't run, I kind of just seem lethargic for most of the day. But when I get up and get out the door, which is most days, man, it just kind of energizes me.
And it's not a given that you would be getting up and getting out of the door these days. And I want to transition a little bit to some of the, you know, accidents that you've really survived, the surgeries and some of the physical things you've had to overcome. Because as a dairy farmer, you got sort of mangled and mutilated in a farm accident. And this is the beginning of a series of accidents that seem really improbable to happen to one person. Take us back to that, yeah, that series of sort of tragedies in your life.
You know, it kind of all started back in 1989, November 13th. Gosh, it'll be 30 years next November. And I got in a hurry that morning, and you know, I was always one preaching farm safety and whatnot. And anyhow, long story short, I got tangled up in a power takeoff, and it just wrapped me all up and started beating me up and taking me around and around and slamming me into the ground. And somehow, by the grace of God, I was able to, as I was getting flipped around, I was able to somehow grab the handle and somehow get the darn thing to stop turning. And to this day, I don't recall how I got myself untangled out of that mess of machinery, but you know, I was all beat up. You know, I had broke all my ribs on my right side, punctured my lung, broke my arm, had a piece of steel driven into my chest, and my left leg was almost torn off. But you know, I had great doctors and surgeons and nurses and physical therapists and people I didn't even know, and I was able to survive. And but then over the next few years, I got in a bad car accident. A lady ran a stop sign and T-boned my car and totaled it out and busted up my back. And so I had some two or three major back surgeries. And then I fell off a cliff on a hike and got busted up again. And it was just kind of one thing after another. And, you know, but I never looked at it and walked out of the house thinking, man, what's going to happen today? Because I'm not that type of person. And you know, people would say to me, gosh, Beardsley, if you didn't have bad luck, you wouldn't have any luck at all. But, you know, I've never really looked at it like that. I never, you know, asked the good Lord, why is this happening to me? I just kind of took it as, well, things happen and for a reason. And there's a reason why I'm still alive. But then, you know, probably the worst thing that happened after all that is, you know, I became addicted to narcotic painkillers, and obviously the opioid crisis that's in the news today. And that was that makes all those accidents that I had seem like a walk in the park. But thankfully that, you know, I was able to get into treatment, and, you know, I've been sober from the drugs for, golly, it'll be, I think, 22 years, knock on wood, in February. So thank the Lord for that.
At your lowest, you're taking 80 to 90 pills a day. You have to convince the DEA agents that you're not dealing, that those are really for personal use. That's how far down you are. That's a long way down to hit rock bottom. How do you pull? How do you pull yourself up from that?
I mean, I was out of control, and you're looking at a kid that I've never done any illicit type drug, like, you know, dope or any cocaine, any of that kind of stuff, you know, never even thought about doing that kind of thing, and never stole as much as a piece of bubble gum, never had been in any trouble. And, you know, the addiction got so far out of hand, I started, you know, not only was I doctor shopping, but then I started to forge my own prescriptions. And thankfully, you know, the day I got caught, I knew I was in a lot of trouble, but I was, you know, I was so blessed and so thankful I was still alive. And I knew the only chance I had to get better was, if I was going to get better, was to be 100% truthful and take responsibility for my actions. And as difficult as it was, especially kind of being in the public eye because of the runner I once was, you know, that was a difficult time, not only for me, but my family. But, you know, I had a lot of friends and family and people that were there to support me and still support me to this day. So that really helped make a difference.
When did you start telling that story after your recovery, when you realized, you know, people know who I am, they remember, if nothing else, they remember the 1982 marathon, and I can use this story, I can use my journey to help guide other people?
Yeah, absolutely. When I had a 1 year of sobriety, I was invited back to where I went for treatment in Fargo, North Dakota, and to share my story with, you know, with others that were just new to a treatment program. And I remember, you know, the year before, sitting out there listening to some person tell his story and thinking I didn't have a problem, you know, because you're in such denial, most people are in the beginning. And it really felt good to share my story. A lot of people don't like to talk about some of the bad things in their lives, but for me, it really helped my sobriety by sharing my story and giving people some hope and know that you can get better. It's not going to be easy, but it's worth every amount of effort that you put into it.
who are the people who helped you from, you know, coaches in running to, you know, people helping you, you know, recover from a life-threatening injury to healing from addiction? Who are the people in your life who are those touchstones for you?
Well, golly, so much of it goes to my own family. You know, my first wife, Mary, you know, she was, and her family was so supportive of me. And even though we've been divorced and for about a dozen years now, and we still remain good friends, and she's remarried, and she went through an awful lot with me. I put her through an awful lot, but you know, she was always there. And my wife, Jill, now, who I'm married to, been married to for, oh gosh, almost 12 years. And, you know, she's been very supportive of, you know, making sure that I keep my sobriety where it needs to be and whatnot. And then, and of course, my close friends, like my closest friends in the world are Mike and Karen Dunlap. I went to school with Mike at South Dakota State, and we've been good friends for 40 years. And him and his wife, Karen, have always, you know, been there for me whenever, ever I needed them. You know, they were there for me, and other friends too. And my mom and dad had passed on by that point, but I know my dad's dying wish when he's dying from pancreatic cancer, it was at the height of my addiction, and he knew something was going on, but he was, his dying wish was that I would hopefully get some help. And thankfully not too long after that, I did.
When you look back at that 1982 marathon, so much has changed. When you watch, you know, the current races and how the crowd is, maintained, the way the coverage is done. You watch those final minutes of the marathon. I mean, it's chaos in the street, and there's a police motorcycle. You're a little bit ahead of Salazar. Then he pulls ahead, and then the police motorcycle, like five of them, sort of surround Salazar, almost as if they think this thing is over. We're going to take this guy to the final. You have to be breathing exhaust at that point. And everyone's screaming in your ears. And then all of a sudden, you're not done. And so you have to sort of kick around the motorcycles, squeeze between the crowd. You catch up to Salazar. But really, for someone who loses the race or comes in second in the race by a second, that moment is pretty crucial. Take me to what that experience was like to be running that final mile of the Boston Marathon, coming down Heartbreak Hill and pushing toward the end.
Well, Lori, back then there was no crowd control. And as you can see from the video, it was one of the first really warm days they had that spring. So everybody was out cheering the runners on. It was about 75 to 80 degrees. And again, no crowd control. And the last few miles, I mean, it was basically enough room for Alberto and I to run side by side. And you know, I, with about 900 meters to go, I'd opened up a little bit of a lead on him. And, you know, at this point, I can't even feel my leg, but somehow I was able to dig down a little deeper to try to open up that gap a little bit on him. And when I did, I got just a terrible hamstring cramp in my right leg. And he, you know, now we're down to, you know, a half mile to go. And at this point, now I'm thinking, oh my gosh, am I even going to finish? And he just kept pulling away. And at one point, he got almost 100 meters ahead of me. And thankfully, I was in the right place at the right time and stepped into a pothole I didn't see and almost fell down, but it jerked my right leg and it popped the knot out, and I got my stride back, and I thought, you know, I might not win this thing, but I'm sure going to give it my very, very best. And, you know, I was able to – we came off of Commonwealth Avenue into Hereford Street, and then at the top of Hereford Street, we made that left-hand turn with about 150 meters to go to the finish. And, you know, I had to go out around the motorbikes, and I got around him, and I caught back up to Alberto with about 100 meters to go. And then it came down to a 100-meter sprint. And unfortunately, I got out kicked and lost by 1.6 seconds. But it's a race. You know, I can't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, but I can remember that race that's going on 37 years ago like I ran it this morning.
Do you fault the motorcycle, though? Because, I mean, at that moment, you know, when you look back on it, do you think, I had to put a little extra effort in there? Is that not part of – because a lot of people would look back and call foul at that.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have tried to say to me – a lot of people have said to me, I should say, is that, oh, if those motorbikes wouldn't have got in your way, you would have won. Well, we don't know that for sure, and I'll be honest with you, Lori, not even that day or any day since have I ever – ever even thought about using that as an excuse because, you know, did they get in my way a little bit? Well, yeah, and I had to go out around them. But I got around him, and I caught back up to Salazar, and then I just got out kicked. So, you know, it's hard to say if I wouldn't have had to go out a little wide if I would have won or not. But, you know, it makes it a compelling story the way it kind of ended like that.
And you had been training for that marathon. It's a hot day, as you mentioned, but you trained in you know, Midwestern blizzard kind of conditions, right? So talk a little bit about just this notion of putting yourself through things that you don't have to, because life has put you through so much, but you've also sought out experiences where you said, I'm going to make myself miserable and endure it, and that is going to make me a better person, a stronger person.
Yes, absolutely. And if you look in, you know, this upper Midwest, Minnesota, the Dakotas, we've produced some incredible, especially in the distance running community over the years, of really good, I mean, Olympic caliber runners. And I think part of it is the toughness that you get from training here when it's, you know, northern Minnesota, we get many mornings, even now when I go out, it'll be 30, 35 below actual temperature, but you go out and you put your miles in. And I know that winter, for 2 months before Boston, I went down to Atlanta, Georgia, and everybody thinks I went down there to get on the, you know, to get out of the cold, but I didn't mind the cold, but I needed to get somewhere where there was lots of hills, and where I live is not very hilly. But that winter, I remember one morning I got up and my temperature outside my little log cabin I lived in out in the woods, the temperature was reading minus 60. and I don't know if it was stupidity or not, but I went out for a run just to see what it was like, and it really wasn't that bad because there was no wind.
Oh, Dick Beardsley, you can meet him and hear more of his life story Monday morning at 10. He's at the Joy Center at Black Hill State University in Spearfish, and then again Tuesday morning at 10, he's at the King Center Hall of Fame Room at the South Dakota School of Mines. Dick Beardsley, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks so much, Laurie. Take care.